Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ, at offbeatoregon.com with the daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. And it's Friday, which means this is going to be a brand new show, which has just come out from under the 60-day embargo period during which our participating newspapers have exclusive rights. Reruns are for Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays and Thursdays. Fridays are for new stuff. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on January 6th of 2019 under the headline, Filming of Worst Western Ever Was a Real Spectacle. Here we go. If you've never heard Harold Hecht's The Way West referred to as a legendary box office bomb, that's probably because of Michael Cimino. Cimino's epic testament to directorship run amok, a baroque 5.5-hour Western picture titled Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, was probably the most colossal box office bomb of all time. Nothing else has even come close. Not even Ishtar. It earned back only 8% of its $44 million budget, equivalent to $132 million today. It lost so much money that it drove its studio, United Artists, out of business. Maybe if United Artists had taken a closer look at one of its earlier box office flops, it would have handled Heaven's Gate differently, because the similarities between it and The Way West are kind of striking. Both were big-budget westerns that aspired to get beyond the Golden West mythology and show the gritty reality of life in the Old West. Both are branded with their creators' names. Of course, only one of those movies was over 5 hours long and included a 360-second long shot of a guy playing a fiddle while roller skating through a massive frontier cowboy skating rink, so maybe not. The Way West was part of the wave of big-budget, shot-on-scene westerns that came out in the mid-1960s in response to the popularity of the spaghetti westerns shot in Italy by directors like Sergio Leone. Leone and his colleagues brought a darker, more chaotic feel to a genre that many Americans had grown bored with after decades of little houses on the prairie, singing cowboys in big white hats, and wholesome maidens in gingham. So American movie makers started looking for darker, edgier stories to tell, and authentic places in which to shoot them, places like Eastern Oregon. Director Andrew McLagan was familiar with the terrain. The previous year, he'd directed Shenandoah, much of which was shot in Lane County. So when doing location scouting for this new Western, he had a good sense of where to look. McLagan had a policy that all the actors had to be in costume and in character on the set at all times, which meant that when they weren't performing for the camera, they were halfway performing for visitors on the set. Some of them found this exhausting, but it made for a movie-making spectacle that local residents would remember for the rest of their lives. Shooting started out in 1966 near Eugene, where a set had been constructed to stand in as Independence, Missouri, and a spectacular scene of a wagon train crossing the Mackenzie River was filmed there. After spending about $1 million shooting in Eugene, the company moved east, where they landed in southern Deschutes and northern Lake counties to drop $1.5 million more. Oregon's Fort Rock stood in for Independence Rock in Wyoming, much to the amusement of local raconteur Rube Long, the sage of Fort Rock, and the Christmas Valley sand dunes stood in for the Western Desert, much to the delight of real estate hustler M. Penn Phillips, who was at this very time working to turn Christmas Valley into a cowboy paradise. Then the whole huge caravan of cast and crew moved on, filming on the Crooked River Ranch, which was at the time a working ranch. The TV commercials with Crooked River Bob and his cowboy hat trick were about a decade in the future, and finishing up near Burns with a scene involving a buffalo stampede. Then the crews headed back to Hollywood to put the film together. As release day approached, the Eugene JCs were working with United Artists to host the world premiere screening of the movie in Eugene, slated for June 13th. They'd hired a public relations firm to get the word out and were well into the project when, to their dismay, the movie was released early. It screened in 21 theaters in New York City on May 24th. Quote, "To add to the JC's woes, the New York reviews of the film were all bad," noted the writer of an AP article about the kerfluffle in the Oregonian the following Wednesday. "The only thing anyone liked was the Oregon scenery." The reviews were, in fact, pretty bleak. Quote, It's all very promising material, but Hecht and McLagan bury it in a panorama of scenery and stock Western cliches, wrote Roger Ebert, whose 2.5-star review was probably the gentlest of the lot. The main issue for most critics was that the film tries to tell too many stories. The plot of the movie is basically a wagon train full of flawed characters of various types making their way across the country, experiencing lots of interpersonal dramas and physical hardships along the way. It's hard for viewers to emotionally invest in all of them at the same time, and the film doesn't make a particularly strong case for why they should, and the tendency among critics watching it for the first time seems to have been to shrug their shoulders, look at their watches, and count down the minutes until they could be back at the office writing a scathing takedown, possibly including the words worst, Western, movie, and ever. Of course, once the first few of these critical reviews came out, the general negativity started to influence others in a classic information cascade. Today, in the cold light of history, many years later, the movie holds up pretty well. In 1967, in the hot blood of the moment, with the sheer momentum of the bad press feeding back into the coverage to influence more bad press, well, United Artists was in for a bumpy ride. At the end of May, the Eugene J.C.'s were gamely trying to put the best face they could on the world premiere debacle. What we've got is a Pacific Northwest premiere. Call it what you want to, but we have the first showing in this area, J.C.'s spokesman Jim Sisler told reporters. But United Artists was not making things any easier for its erstwhile partners. In a press conference, studio representative Murray Lafayette emphatically declared that he was in no way, shape, or manner prepared to make a statement on the subject of the press conference he'd called and added less than helpfully, as far as I'm concerned, the less I know about it, the better I feel. He did, however, mention that Michael Whitney, one of the supporting role actors in the flick, he played the philandering newlywed Johnny Mack, would be there, and the three male leads would be represented by Troy Donahue, who wasn't actually in the movie at all. Troy, as our younger readers may not recall, was a tall, handsome blonde actor who had been one of the hottest sex symbols in the business about 10 years before this, but whose career had cooled considerably as a result of an ill-considered feud with studio mogul Jack Warner. Lafayette said producer Harold Hecht would be there, though, which, the reporter adds, may be considered an act of bravery. Critics who have seen the film thus far have universally panned it. Bravery or not. As the days passed, the brutality of the criticism of the movie mounted to the point that the United Artists people simply canceled the premiere, leaving the J.C.'s holding the bag, and slunk back to Hollywood to hide under their desks. Key sources in this story included works by Gregory P. Shine and the archives of the Portland Oregonian. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m. So the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.